the Radio Ranch in beautiful Sugar Land, Texas, where life truly is sweeter. It's the Bombastic Blogcast for Wednesday, February 28th, 2024. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
Hey there yourself, defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, and one heck of a nice guy. Let's get things officially started with...
The Daily Denogram.
You got it. Words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets. You get to make the call. It says here, falling in love is awfully simple. Falling out of love is simply awful. Perhaps if we could just trip in and out of love, maybe the anxiety wouldn't be so bad.
You know, before this is over, I'm going to need a whole lot of serious therapy.
Let's move along now to the so-called educational part of the blogcast.
Twisted history.
Yeah, here we
go. Gather around, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
Big stuff.
Some cool, some not so cool. Just the same. You need to know your twisted history.
Well, you should.
You might be quizzed.
See, there you go. Well, kids, it was on this day in 1959, during the early days of the space race, Discoverer 1, an American spy satellite, the first object intended to achieve a polar orbit, was launched but failed to achieve orbit. In an official statement, the director of the program said, "Well, back to the drawing board." And it was on this day in 1983, the final episode of MASH aired with almost 110 million viewers. Just as the series was wrapping production, a brush fire destroyed most of the outdoor set. And the fire was written into the final episode as a forest fire caused by enemy incendiary bombs that forced the 4077th to move out. How about that?
MASH 4077.
Right here on the top of my desk, I have an article. It's an uncredited article about election workers resigning en masse. And it says here, the unforeseeable consequence of intense scrutiny. Now, I don't know what kind of a connotation you draw from that, but to me it means, well, we're going to crack down on the elections and make sure they're honest. And the election workers don't like this? Is that what's happening? Well, we dig into the article and it says, across the nation, election offices are facing an unprecedented exodus of workers, a troubling development as elections approach. The necessity of ensuring the democratic processes run smoothly has long been the priority for these civil servants, yet in the face of increasing scrutiny and allegations surrounding the electoral process, many have chosen to step down from their roles. Really? Okay. Then what's happening here to make them actually follow through and do this? Well, the article continues by saying this wave of resignations is a direct outcome of the heightened suspicions and intensified oversight by political factions and the public at large. Our electoral workers have traditionally operated in environments of trust and procedural integrity, but the recent climate has visibly shifted. The meticulous scrutiny has transitioned past critical watchfulness, transcending into a zone of harassment. Or is it harassment? An unfortunate reality for those committed to a thankless job. Well, I want to defer to an article on a website from an Olympia, Washington. Actually, it's a Seattle, Washington TV station, KOMO News. And the headline reads, "Washington lawmakers advance bill making it a felony to threaten election workers." Okay. Sounds innocuous enough. I suppose that there has been a fair amount of harassment or threats targeting election workers over the years. But let me read there the TV station's article. Again, this is KOMO News in Seattle. And it says here, the Washington State Senate voted overwhelmingly Thursday to make harassing election workers a felony. 3 months after several county election offices received envelopes containing suspicious powder, including three testing positive for fentanyl, and had to be evacuated. Democratic Senator Manka Dhingra said during the vote, "This cannot be something we take as normal. We have to make sure that our election workers are protected, that people who participate and engage in our democracy have faith that the system works well, and that we don't have bad actors that can actually disrupt vote counts." The bill is among a wave of legislation across the U.S. seeking to boost protections for these workers in the lead up to the 2024 election. Amid an increasing number of threats, some attribute to false claims by former President Donald Trump and his allies that the 2020 election was stolen. Tra-la. So this is what's really behind this. And it leads me to wonder, okay, do we really have a problem with harassment? And certainly, I'd love to know if it's coming from the right. If there is any harassment, is it coming from the right? I doubt that it is. And what does this have to do with Donald Trump? I mean, all he wants is an honest election. That's all we want. He's merely the mouthpiece for people like you and me, right? This says here, 23 states are considering bills addressing protections, according to the nonprofit advocacy group Public Citizen. In Maryland, for example, lawmakers are considering legislation to enable authorities to prosecute people who threaten to harm election officials or their immediate family members. The bill in Washington would increase the possible penalty for harassing an election worker in person or by mail from up to 1 year in jail to up to 5 years in prison. It would also give targeted workers the opportunity to join a program run by the Secretary of State's office designed to keep their address confidential. Well, it goes into more detail, but nothing really earth-shaking there, nothing groundbreaking. But you look at the overall impact of this, and it's twofold. First, the loss of experienced staff could leave our elections vulnerable by destabilizing the entire electoral process. The guidance of seasoned workers is so important because their nuanced understanding of the complexities of election administration isn't easily replaced. You just don't throw somebody green and fresh and brand new in there and expect things to run smoothly. They won't. Because as novices assume the roles, the risk of errors, some of them probably pretty big, inadvertently increases, which ironically dovetails back into fueling further skepticism about the election's credibility. See, it's kind of a catch-22 situation there. Plus, this exodus highlights an unsettling trend toward the politicization of what should be an impartial and straightforward civic duty. So the increasing pressure on election workers, often dovetailed with inflammatory political rhetoric, feeds into a cycle where defending the probity of our democratic systems becomes challenging. And of course, fueling all of this is social media. I mean, you don't have to go far. You don't have to spend much time on social media to find some real, I don't know, angry rhetoric. And the people in the country these days, thanks to the economy, are very angry. So what about the 2024 election? How's it going to be? Well, there's speculation that it's going to be worse. And you have to wonder for who and for what reason. Because you talk to some poll workers, they're telling you the internet's not working in the polling places. And they had to take ballots and put them into separate bins. I can tell you we're going to be going through this again in 2024, right after the election, the morning after. The allegations are going to be flying like confetti. So we're getting all these calls for reform. We need more reform. We need election reform. Yes, we do. But in the form of what? I mean, there's the prevailing suggestion that a need to fortify protections for election workers, which would mean instituting measures that insulate them from undue pressure and threats stemming from their professional obligations, simplifying, streamlining election processes. That could also reduce burdens on workers and mitigate potential triggers for public doubts. And then you're going to have that sector that says, well, we need more computerization, more automation. Well, I don't know. I mean, over the November 2024 election, I see nothing but huge question marks. Now, there is an urgent necessity, a very urgent necessity, to reaffirm public faith in electoral systems. Now, how do you restore that confidence? I don't know. It may require targeted campaigns highlighting the integrity and dedication of election personnel. But you do something like that, and more often than not, it comes across looking like a propaganda campaign, which, come to think of it, it is. That's what it is. So meanwhile, counties and states have to scramble to replace their departing workforce. Now, this is happening regionally. It's not happening nationally. There are some states where elections work better than in others. But as a society, we've got to recognize the critical nature of the election workers, the polling place workers' roles, and the need to support rather than undermine those who help, I don't know, solidify the core aspects of our democracy. Because right there, that's the symbol of democracy. The polling place, be it at an elementary school or a grocery store, wherever the voting takes place, that is the very symbol, that is the very foundation of our Judeo-Christian culture, our democracy. Yesterday, the news got out, but it wasn't splashed all over the place. But it did get out that South Dakota GOP Governor Kristi Noem is rumored to be on the short list for VP. She did meet with Trump at Mar-a-Lago this week. And, let's go ahead and read what the Daily Caller reported. A new Kaplan Strategies Wisconsin poll released on February 23rd shows Noem is the preferred pick to be Trump's running mate. Trump has reportedly been considering Noem and a list of others to be his running mate. According to that poll, Noem had the highest favorability rating, with 39% of voters saying they have a very or somewhat favorable view of her. Then Ron DeSantis came in second with 28% of the vote, ahead of Vivek Ramaswamy. In their straw poll, Noem and Ramaswamy shared the most votes, 15% each, during the annual Conservative Political Action Committee summit, you know, the CPAC summit, which was last weekend. And then following her with 8% was New York Representative Elise Stefanik and Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard would be good. She's a former Democrat congresswoman. And I maintain that she only ran as a Democrat because she was running to represent Hawaii. And if you're going to win public office in Hawaii, you have to be a Democrat. I mean, they're even worse than Illinois. And Ms. Gabbard was in third place with 9%. Now, Fox News host Kayleigh McEnany, who for a long while there was Donald Trump's, was President Trump's press secretary, mentioned, I guess this was last week, who she believes her former boss is going to choose as his running mate should he go on to win the 2024 GOP presidential nomination. During a segment on the Outnumbered program, I think it runs around noon Eastern time, McEnany and her fellow co-hosts made it clear they think Tim Scott is a favorite to get the nod from Trump. And it makes sense to me because, first of all, Tim Scott is very, very well respected. He's brilliant. He's been in Washington politics for a long time. He knows who does what. He knows who you have to get along with to get something done or passed. So I don't know. But McEnany said after the show played some clips of Scott answering voters' questions and shaking hands, she said, "What I find fascinating from what we just watched is that was him showing I have the chops to be your VP. Because in addition to winning over independents, winning over suburban moms, the VP pick must be someone who's the most effective voice for Donald Trump as he's embattled in these court battles. He just proved he can handle that." And then co-host Emily Campagno, and I just love her. She is so bubbly. She's got so much energy. I wish I could tap into just a tenth of it. But Emily Campagno agreed. And she said, what I thought this illustrated so beautifully is that Donald Trump has surrounded himself not with facsimile robots, but with independent thinkers that are committed to the ideals and values of conservatism and the Republican Party. It just goes to show, for me, the brand versus party and the brand versus values that the GOP is constantly fighting against the Democrats about. And what I mean by that is every time you put a surrogate for Biden up, they say the same. Biden is great and everything's fine. It's oversimplified. It's overgeneralized. It's honestly not thoughtful. They're facsimiles of each other because they have the brand down. Emily Campagno, she's terrific. And she also said that the GOP, where we struggle, is at brand identification. But we're committed to the ideals and values. So we have Tim Scott, so thoughtful, so intellectual, so clear about where he stands on issues. He's not just saying, what does Trump think? Okay, I'm going to say it. He's saying, this is what I think, and you can trust me because this is what we all need right now. And yes, and the army of Christ is absolutely rising up, and he's tapping into that too. So there you have it. You know, last month, Scott chose to back Trump over another GOP primary opponent and his own state's former governor, Nikki Haley. But that was kind of a no-brainer, right? I mean, if you know anything at all about Tim Scott and what we know about Nikki Haley, you know, that shouldn't be a big surprise. So he said that it's time for us to unite our party so that we make sure that the only target we're talking about is firing Joe Biden. Says the best way for us to get rid of Joe Biden as our president is to unite our party now behind Donald Trump. Well, truer words were never spoken. Getting rid of Joe Biden and the people, the puppet masters behind him, is so incredibly important. Vastly important. Can you really, when you think about it, can you really envision the shape this country will be in another 2 years? Probably won't take that long, but think about 2 years up the road. If Biden or Biden policies are retained in November of 2024. This is kind of interesting, and our thanks to Martin Walsh over there at Conservative Brief for the story. But the Senate, in an overwhelmingly bipartisan manner, voted to table a resolution that would have required the State Department to report on Israel's actions in Gaza after the thing that triggered it all back on October 7th. And, you know, you had 1,300 people killed in that one event on October 7th and abducted hundreds of political prisoners, including Americans. Now, the vote comes after Biden twice bypassed Congress and approved weapon sales to Israel, which is continuing to carry out these operations in Gaza because we all know they have to. The real enemy here is Hamas. So the resolution in part stated, quote, the Senate requests that the Secretary of State, not later than 30 days after the date of the adoption of this resolution, transmit to the Committee on Foreign Relations of the Senate and the Committee on Foreign Affairs of the House of Representatives under Section 502BC of the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961, a statement regarding Israel's human rights practices that has been prepared in collaboration with the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, and the Office of the Legal Advisor. Well, the resolution was tabled on a 72-11 vote with 17 senators not voting at all. See, earlier this month, some Democrats in the Senate were upset with Biden after his first decision to bypass Congress and send more weapons to Israel as Israel continues its offensive in Gaza because they have to. I may have mentioned that. Now, Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State, had notified Congress about its second emergency determination to cover over $147.5 million in equipment sales, including new fuses and chargers for the 155-millimeter shells already purchased by the Israeli military. And that's according to a report in the Washington Examiner. So in a statement, Blinken said, "Given the urgency of Israel's defensive needs, the secretary notified Congress that he had exercised his delegated authority to determine an emergency existed, necessitating the immediate approval of the transfer." Well, the emergency declaration by law allows the executive branch to waive the normal requirement of congressional review, typically required for sales of U.S. military equipment to other countries. Also, the examiner noted, quote, "But it's the second such emergency weapons sale the Biden administration has greenlit for Israel in less than a month without congressional approval." So there you go, that end run around Congress. Blinken used the same powers just weeks earlier on December 9th when the administration pushed through a separate $106.5 million tranche of weapons funding to purchase nearly 14,000 rounds of tank ammunition. The back-to-back emergency declarations for Israel sparked fresh criticism from Senate Democrats who've cited concerns that the Israeli military has failed to take the necessary steps to prevent civilian casualties in Gaza as the death toll surpasses 21,000, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. Well, you know, here again, that's a count from Hamas. Are they telling the truth? Probably not. But some Democrats in the chamber criticized the process by which the State Department approved the sales. And they argued that using an emergency determination as a means of approving the weapons for a foreign ministry, foreign military, means that the Biden administration has bypassed an essential check on the executive branch. Now, Tim Kaine, Democrat senator out of Virginia, said, "Unnecessarily bypassing Congress means keeping the American people in the dark. We need a public explanation of the rationale behind this decision, the second such decision this month." So by failing to include the legislative branch in the decision-making process for foreign military sales, the Biden administration's decision undermines transparency and weakens accountability. And that was a statement from Senator Chris Van Hollen, also a Democrat from Maryland. Now, Peter Welch, Democrat out of Vermont, says the weapons authorized for and sent to Israel have been used to devastating effect in Gaza, contributing to the death and injury of countless civilians and the displacement of an estimated 2 million people. He also said the war in Gaza has generated immense controversy, boy howdy, and concern in the United States and around the world. The president should follow the established procedure of submitting his arms sales recommendations to Congress for prior approval. This one event, this October 7th event that triggered the war between Israel and Hamas, because that's what it is. It's Israel and Hamas. Israel is not at war with Gaza. Naturally. Israel is at war with Hamas, and Hamas must be defeated. And I'm not sure that there's enough unity on Capitol Hill to get us to that point, to where Hamas is defeated. But this move here in the Senate was kind of surprising. You know, this is just this just shows you how divided we are, not just as a nation, but our political system is over this issue. And I don't know how we clear this up, especially when you have a mainstream media that has a tendency to lean toward the Hamas point of view. The mainstream media constantly pointing their fingers at Israel, and Israel is practicing genocide. That's garbage. That's nothing even remotely resembling the truth. This is the big programming note that I knew was coming, and I had mentioned this a couple of months ago, but I'm going through a divorce, and in the process, we have to get rid of this house. We've already made a deal on it, but I have a lot of cleanup to do in this place, and I have to move the studio and the Dan Gallo production studio. My move is going to have to, it's going to have to run somewhat flawlessly, because it is this studio that I use for my syndicated radio program through RFC Media. So I can't be down for too long. But the other things, the minutiae that I have to take care of during the next couple of months, certainly the next month, are such that I'm just not going to have the time to do the podcasts, you know, the blogcasts. So I'm going to go on hiatus with the blogcast. I'm shooting for a return by June, maybe sooner, depending on how well things go. My daughter, Lisa, down in the Clear Lake City area, has been showing me properties that are just awesome. And there's one in particular that I'm trying to bag. And if I get in there, it's going to be terrific. But moving everything without missing a beat on my syndicated radio show, that's the real challenge there. And I hope I can pull that off. And I'm going to ask you for your prayers. And in the meantime, I'll be praying for you that the political changes we're going through these days are in keeping with your desires for this country and the preservation of our Judeo-Christian culture. Feel free to rattle my cage on Facebook and be watching Facebook for the return of the Bombastic Blogcast. I'm going to make as much noise as I can when I get back online with that. Thank you so much for listening. To take us out of here, let's go to the Comedy Corner with Johnny W.
I am from Nashville, Tennessee, so this is cool to be here. Okay, you're just going to woo? That's fine. Just woo with every city name? That's okay. I love getting to travel. People are usually super nice. There's a little judgment when you're from the South. We were in Wisconsin a couple weeks ago. People in Wisconsin think they don't have an accent, and they think my accent is adorable. Slave's like, your accent is precious. Where are you from? I said, I'm from Tennessee. She was like, do you date your sister? That's what she said. I was like, no, we broke up. All right. Too far, lady. I'm kidding, guys. We're still together. You make it work, okay? You stay in Tennessee, all right? Focus on the family. That's what we say. I like that no matter where you're from, I've noticed this, no matter where you're from, there's an area more backwards than you that you can point to. Have you noticed that? It's like a coping skill. Tennessee, we need it, okay? We're near the bottom in education. We're like, yeah, we are bad, but what about those slack-jawed yokels in Alabama? Good grief. They're the worst. Alabama's like, yeah, but come on, Mississippi. They can barely read Mississippi. Mississippi's like, yeah, but Paraguay. So that's... I love getting to travel. It's my favorite part. I was just in Iowa for the first time a couple months ago. Have anyone ever been to Iowa? Anyone ever been? Guys, if you get a chance, to go to Iowa, go ahead and skip it. Here's the deal. Save you a trip. I'm only judging it by the weirdest thing I saw there. I was on a tour bus with another comedian. We're driving along. It's just corn everywhere. Then we see a funeral home. The funeral home sign said this, now offering double-decker grave plots. I was like, you pull this bus over right now. I got questions. We get out, the guy was digging the hole. I go, perfect, I'll ask you, what do you mean double-decker? He goes, well, we go 10 feet down instead of just 6, we go 10. You know, then we put the first person in, you know, then we put 4 feet of dirt, and then I guess they wait. And I want to be there when that second person goes in. You know, so I can be like, king me. You know what I'm saying? I just need, you can move freely after that. That's your best move. Why stop at 10 feet, go 20 feet down, put your whole family, just play Connect Four. Do whatever you like, it's Iowa. I told that joke in a little Baptist church last week. It did not go well. This lady came down to the front after the show. I would never have a double-decker grave plot, sir. I'm like, no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you. She's like, I'm not offended, but my husband's not saved. You know, so if I die first, then they put him on top, then the dead in Christ try to rise, he's blocking me. And look, that's just... That's just science, y'all. That's...
That's it?